There are two parts to our scripture reading this morning, Revelations chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, and then Acts chapter 18. Revelation. To the angel of the church in Ephesus, write, these are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands. I know your works, your toil, and your patient endurance. I know that you cannot tolerate evildoers. You have tested those who claim to be apostles, but are not, and have found them to be false. I also know that you are enduring patiently and bearing up for the sake of my name, and that you have not grown weary. But I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love that you had at first. And then from the book of Acts. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they worked together. By trade, they were tent makers. Every Sabbath, he would argue in the synagogue and would try to convince Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with proclaiming the word, testifying to the Jews that the Messiah was Jesus. When they opposed and reviled him, in protest he shook the dust from his clothes and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on I will go to the Gentiles. Then he left the synagogue and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the official of the synagogue, became a believer in the Lord, together with all his household. And many of the Corinthians who heard Paul became believers and were baptized. One night the Lord said to Paul in a vision, do not be afraid, but speak, and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will lay a hand on you to harm you, for there are many in this city who are my people. He stayed there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. Excuse me. But when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a unified attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal. They said, this man is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law. Just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to the Jews, excuse me, if it were a matter of crime or serious villainy, I would be justified in accepting the complaint of you Jews. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names and your own law, see to it yourself. I do not wish to be a judge of these matters. And he dismissed them from the tribunal. Then all of them seized Sosthenes, the official of the synagogue, and beat him in front of the tribunal. But Gallio paid no attention to any of these things. After staying there for a considerable time, Paul said farewell to the believers and sailed to Syria, accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. At Cenchreae, he had his hair cut, for he was under a vow. When they reached Ephesus, he left them there, but first he himself went into the synagogue and had a discussion with the Jews. When they asked him to stay longer, he declined. But on taking leave of them, he said, I will return to you if God wills. And then he set sail from Ephesus. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up to Jerusalem and greeted the church, and then went down to Antioch. After spending some time there, he departed and went from place to place throughout the region of Galatia and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples. Now there came to Ephesus a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria. He was an eloquent man, well versed in the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with burning enthusiasm and taught accurately the things concerning Jesus, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue, but when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained the way of God to him more accurately. And when he wished to cross over to Achaia, the believers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. On his arrival, he greatly helped those who through grace had become believers, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, showing by the scriptures that the Messiah is Jesus. This is the word of the Lord.
When you've got a passage like that there in Acts, it's nice to have somebody with a seminary education as liturgist with all those names and places. Well, this morning, we are talking a little bit about grace, as a matter of fact, and we're talking about a few other things, too. We had a bit of a long passage. We had a short passage and a long passage in our scripture this morning. The long passage was a little longer than we usually do, but again, sometimes you got to tell the story, and sometimes the story takes up a lot of space, and that's just the way it is. But we're talking about the church of Ephesus this morning, just a little bit. Now, when we read Revelation, we tend to associate it with end times or future prophecies and those sorts of things, but that's not really why it was written. It was written for things that were happening in real time. It was written to seven churches in an area called Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. And it was written for these churches, and specifically, this passage we read this morning was written to the church of Ephesus. Now, Ephesus was an extraordinarily important church. It started out as an early church in Christianity. It grew tremendously. Some scholars believe, we're not for sure, but some scholars believe that Mary, Jesus' mother, actually lived at Ephesus, that she was taken by John to Ephesus to live out the rest of her days. And we do know some of the apostles actually retired in Ephesus. They, as they got older and got to where they could no longer travel, they would travel to Ephesus as their one last place to travel and spend the rest of their days there and preach and teach there. Ephesus was an extraordinarily important church. And Jesus commends them in this writing. He commends them and he says, you know, I appreciate the work that you're doing. I appreciate your struggle against sin. I appreciate the love that you have. I appreciate your sheer size of a church of thousands. But he says, you've lost your first love. Now, what Jesus means by this when he says this is he says they've lost their passion for the gospel. They've lost that heart that makes them do what the things that they do. I mean, they were doing everything God wanted them to do. They were doing all the things they were supposed to do. They were in church. They were feeding the people, but their heart for the gospel had gone away, and they lost their love that they had for Christ. So we contrast that this morning with the passage from Paul, and we see, it's kind of a long passage, but we see a pattern of ministry of Paul tooth and nail fighting to let the gospel of Christ be known to all the people of the world. And as he travels to Ephesus, a church that lost its first love, and from among those thousands, he picked a couple, a handful, who had a real passion for God, and he sent them out into the world, and they taught about Christ, and they taught the world about who God is through Jesus. This morning, we're beginning a sermon series entitled Revival. Revival isn't a word that you hear a lot in the Methodist Church. It's really not a word you hear a lot anymore. Every once in a while, you'll hear about a revival being held somewhere, or a tent revival, trying to reclaim the glory days back in the 1800s when you would have these tent revivals and all the churches in the community of various denominations would come together and they would preach for hours and hours every day and people by the thousands would come to know Christ for the first time. Nowadays, often tent revivals are one church and everybody from that church comes and everybody from that church re-gives their life to Christ just like they did last year. There's not a lot of evangelism really going on in revivals today. Sometimes, certainly Billy Graham was an exception to that rule, but a lot of times we're not really seeing a lot of real evangelism. That's probably because we've lost that first love. But we're talking about revival this morning because revival is what our church needs. Revival, awakening, getting back to what we were and being made new. You know, we all have those times when we need to be revitalized, when we get burned out on things. And I'm sure you can think of an example for yourself, maybe being burned out of a job. You've been doing the same thing for 20 years, and it was exciting at first, but now it's getting a little tiresome. Maybe it's a relationship. Maybe there's a person in your life who, you know, you really appreciated at one time, but now the friendship just isn't there anymore, and you've kind of burned out on it. Maybe it's just even an activity that you enjoyed. You're starting to just get burned out on. Most of you know that Ashley and I are avid motorcyclists. The average motorcyclist rides about 2,000 miles a year. These are two friends of ours that ride with us about 1,000 miles a year, and but we ride about 10,000 miles a year, so we ride quite a bit more than the average. And I can tell you, we do a lot of trips. That's one of our favorite things to do on our motorcycles is take a long trip. And I can tell you that even though as excited as I am to get on that bike and load it up with luggage and just be ready to hit the road and be gone for a week on the bike, when 500 miles are gone, the first place I want to get is off that bike as quick as I can. You know, we get burned out. And of course, then tomorrow I start all over again and I'm ready to go again. But we do get burned out of things, even things we really enjoy and really love and appreciate. And we're talking about revival over these next 6 weeks because the church has gotten a little bit burned out. The church as a whole has gotten to the point where we've lost our passion for the gospel. We'll attend and we'll be in worship occasionally. We'll sing our hymns. And if we get an opportunity, if somebody asks us, we'll talk about God. But we've lost the passion that grew the church in the first place. We've lost the passion that took nothing and just Christ and turned it into the largest religion in the world. We've lost the passion that came to America to teach the people about God and grew the largest Christian movements in the world since the original Christian movement in the first century. We need a revival, and what we're going to look at over the next 6 weeks is the last time that happened. The last time that happened was the beginning of the Methodist movement in the 1700s with John Wesley, when the church went from stagnant and bored and uninterested in what God had to say to growing rapidly. For 180 years, unheard of, 180 years, the Methodist church grew every year. For 50 years, it started a new church every day for 50 years. That's an incredible revival that happened, and it needs to happen again. And so we're going to look at what happened the first time, and we're going to see what it would take to happen to have it happen again. Our spiritual lives get burnt out, and that's what we're talking about today. That's going to be the focus for today. We get burnt out, and we suddenly get to the point where we are no longer as interested. I'm going to repeat a statistic from last week. Last week I told you that 21,000 people less worshiped on Sunday than they did the Sunday before, and that's true again today. The decline of the Christian church in America is so rapid that about 21,000 people a week leave the church. That means that last Sunday, there were 21,000 more people worshiping across the country than there are today. That's a pretty staggering number. And that's totally in contrast to 180 years of growth without stopping. And it's in contrast to the incredible explosion that happened around the Methodist Church and all the other denominations that also grew when the faith of God started to become important again. We looked at our two scripture passages to look at a time in history before modern history, and a time in biblical times, and a time with Paul when the church grew. And interestingly, the church grew out of a vibrant church. Not because the church was passionate about God. Jesus told us that they weren't passionate about God, but they were big. And Paul went to them with a few people that he gathered along the way, and he sent them out, and he evangelized to them. And I want to point a quick contrast to how he evangelized. It was not a tent revival in Ephesus. It was not getting folks to pray a prayer and sending them off in Ephesus. It was not making them read a book and sending them home in Ephesus. Paul spent time with them, and he taught them. And my favorite part of that whole passage is over and over again, it repeats the phrase that after Paul was done with these people, they went on to defend the gospel. Paul gave them such a knowledge of God, along with Aquila and these other ones that he was with, he gave them such a knowledge of God that when they left, they didn't leave saying, oh, yeah, I've been baptized and I've prayed a prayer. They said, oh, I can defend this faith. I can talk to others about it. I can go back to my synagogue and I can defend Jesus through the scriptures. I can crack open the scriptures and I can tell my Jewish brothers and sisters, this is where Jesus is. I can go back to my Gentile land of pagans, of people who don't believe in any God or believe in multiple gods, and I can say, you don't realize what you're missing right under your nose. I can show you Jesus. That's what happened to grow the church. It wasn't Paul growing 100,000 Christians. It was Paul who grew a handful. Paul, with less people than are in this room today, started essentially and grew the Christian church because he taught. And we kind of draw a contrast to Paul with John Wesley, who kind of did the same thing. He taught. He wanted people to know who Christ was. So to begin our series, we're going to have to understand the kind of world that John Wesley was born into. I think religious turmoil is the best word or best phrase to describe what was going on in England. In 1517, a guy named Martin Luther, you've probably heard of him, nailed 95 theses to a church door. Now I want you to understand something about that. In most of the paintings, you're going to see a bright red, attractive, tall door, and you're going to see this elegantly written scroll, and you're going to see a giant stake and a giant mallet, and Martin Luther looks like he's about to drive that stake right through that door. The reality was it was a bulletin board, okay? In that time period, the church door was what you put your announcements on. If you were having a baby, you put it on the church door. If you were having a potluck dinner, you nailed it to the church door. If you were having a sale at the hardware store, you nailed it to the church door. Everything got nailed to the church door. And Martin Luther was an academic individual. He was a very well-educated and well-learned individual. And he wrote down 95 problems he had with the Pope, chiefly of which was the sale of indulgences, literally get out of hell free card. You could actually go to the church and say, hey, I want to cheat on my spouse. What is that going to cost me? I mean, they would really let you do that. And then they would give you this indulgence that would allow you to commit this sin without punishment. Obviously, for anybody who read the Bible, like Martin Luther, especially a scholar of the Bible, that was so theologically wrong, it wasn't even on the same planet. So passioned by that, passioned by the fact that the Pope at the time had the gall to do something so theologically wrong, he decided to write 95 things wrong with the Pope, essentially. And he nailed the church door. It was just an announcement. It was just a paper, a blog post, to put it in modern terms, a newspaper article, an editorial on his own opinion about something. But people read it, and people liked it, and something crazy happened, and the Pope wasn't too happy about it. So Martin Luther kind of ended there with his 95 theses. Not a lot really happened. A lot happened, but with Martin Luther himself, not a lot happened. In fact, he wanted to stay Catholic. He never had an intention ever to start the Protestant Reformation. He had an intention instead to start a Reformation within the Roman Catholic Church. So Martin Luther nails his 95 theses, and people began for the first time in centuries to say, I wonder if the church could be wrong. I wonder if it's possible for the clergy who lead the church to be making poor decisions. I wonder if it's possible for the theology of the church to not be the theology of God. That was a very dangerous question for them to ask if you're the Pope, and especially if you're the Pope who is fundraising through bad theology. So this continues, and it goes, and it grows, and it grows. And in England, not much changes. They remain Roman Catholic. They don't become, at first, among the Protestant churches until a guy named King Henry VIII. Now, King Henry had a wife, and his wife had this problem where she couldn't have any children. Now, the problem with a wife who can't have any children when you're a king is the thing about being a king is you don't elect your heir. Your heir comes from your wife. And when your wife can't have any children, suddenly you're worried about your family lineage continuing to have the throne. And any good king knows what happens when a king dies without an heir. Horrible, horrible infighting about which distant relative is going to assume the throne. And so the king is very concerned about having an heir. And so he wants to have an annulment. An annulment is a church-blessed divorce, if you will. In that time period, there was no idea or concept of divorce in a court. You might go to court to fight over property if both you and your spouse own property. But in England in the 17th century, let's just face it, your wife didn't own property. You owned it all, and the men owned it all. And if they dissolved the marriage with their wife, they had to have the church's blessing. And very rarely would they get that blessing. However, in certain circumstances, given the context and the culture of the time, thankfully we've evolved since then, but given the context and the culture of the time, not being able to have children was a very valid reason for an annulment. If your wife couldn't have children, she couldn't fulfill her duties as a wife. In fact, they would even go so far as to say she couldn't fulfill her covenant with God and you if she couldn't have children. It was her fault. Again, thankfully, we've evolved past that point, and we know more about the human body, and more importantly, we have a greater respect for one another to back up when Jesus said that we are neither male nor female, but instead one in Christ. But that was the way it was then. And King Henry VIII goes to the Pope and says, I need an annulment for my wife because I need to have a new wife so that I can have an heir. And the Pope says, remember how you don't want the church running your country, and remember how you want to assume your own authority, and remember how you want to be the king of the country, and you want the Pope just to be the religious leader? You remember how you said all those things? You can't have an annulment. So King Henry's not particularly happy with the Pope. You see, King Henry and the Pope have kind of had this power struggle going on for a while. Not a big one. No wars going on, but they're each trying to find out who has more authority in England. Because in some countries, the Pope has the most authority by far. In some countries, the king edges it out just a little bit. So King Henry's trying to find out what England is. And he certainly finds it out when the Pope says, in effect, you cannot have an heir to your throne. So King Henry says, I'll lean it back the other way. England isn't going to have a Pope anymore. So England excommunicates the Pope, if you will. And the Church of England was born. Now, what we need to understand is that the Church of England at that time was not Protestant. It would not be accurate to call them Protestant. They weren't a part of the Protestant Reformation, and they weren't Protestant in theology. They were 100% Roman Catholic in everything but the Pope. They retained the same priests, the same bishops, the same churches, the same theology and doctrine, the same practices and liturgies. The only thing that changed is that they no longer recognized the authority of the Pope in Rome. Instead, they recognized the authority of the Archbishop of Canterbury, which was a particular bishop that they elected to be the spiritual leader of the church. And as we talked about a couple weeks ago, what went along with that was the Archbishop of Canterbury swears allegiance to the throne. See how he did that? He got rid of the Pope. He replaced him with a guy who answers to him. That works out pretty good when you're the king. So that works really good for King Henry for a while. He has an heir to the throne, Edward. And Edward comes along. And Edward says, you know, I've been doing some religious studying myself, and this new Protestant thing, this newfangled theology of Protestantism makes a lot of sense to me. I like the idea of it. So England, we're going to be Protestant now that I'm king. See what happens when the spiritual leaders are under authority of the king? You can do that. And he changes the theology of the Church of England to fit Protestant theology. And suddenly the people of England are Protestant. They were Catholic yesterday, they're Protestant today, all of them, all at once. So I imagine that's a little bit confusing for the people of England, but they go along with it because King Edward's king. And King Edward dies after not very long in office, if you will. And Queen Mary takes over. Queen Mary has a nickname. Does anybody know that nickname? She is the Bloody Mary. That was her nickname. Bloody Mary got that nickname because Bloody Mary was Catholic in her theology, not Protestant. But the country she served was Protestant in theology. So she decided the quickest solution to that is to kill everybody who's Protestant in theology. So she executes many of the priests and many of the archbishops and bishops of the Church of England, and she also executes anybody who seems to have a theology that's too Protestant and who speaks out against the Catholic Church. She returns the church to Rome and restores the Pope to his authority over the church. And all is fine and good, right? Well, I mean, for those who survived. And things continue, and things go okay. And then there's another king. King James comes along, Mary's son. Here comes James. King James says, you know what? I think my mom was wrong. I think we should be more Protestant. But I don't think we should be so Protestant that we ignore the historical traditions of the Catholic Church. So he forms a new Church of England, which is blending Catholic and Protestant theologies. And he even says, I'm going to give you a brand new Bible. He creates the Authorized Version. He commissions the scholars to produce the Authorized Version, which would later be renamed the King James Version, right? And so in the 1600s, he creates the Authorized Version. And then later on, under King James, the Articles of Organization, the Book of Common Prayer, and the first archbishops of the official Church of England in 1617 were formed. Or 1662, sorry. 1662 were formed. So officially, again, we have the Church of England. And this time it's a blend of Catholic and Protestant theologies, and it is what it is today. And so far, they've made it a whole couple hundred years without changing again. But you can imagine what it was like for somebody growing up like John Wesley. John Wesley was born in 1703 in Epworth, England. It's a little town in northeastern England. A very, very small town, very historic town. If you go there today, it's going to look like it did when John Wesley was there. As a matter of fact, the hotel John Wesley stayed in when he came back to visit is still open. You can go stay there if you want. And in his time, you remember, we're 40 years after the organization of the Church of England. People are kind of fed up. It's not happening in one lifetime. It's happening over the period of a couple of decades, but it's still happening. And in a period of a few decades, the Church of England is radically changing its theology, seemingly left and right. And even to the point of my ancestors were Catholic, and then they were Protestant, and now I'm some sort of mix between the two. And the lineage of faith is gone, and there's a lot of disillusionment about faith. People began to say, why should I trust the government? Whoa, have you ever heard that before? Why should I trust the government to make my religious decisions for me? Why is it the king gets to decide whether I'm Catholic or Protestant or some sort of mix in between? Why does the king or queen get to decide who my priest is at my church? Why does the king get to decide who the archbishop is of the area I live in? Why is it not that people who devoted their life to ministry make these decisions and teach me and lead me? Why is it somebody who was born to a throne teaches me and makes these decisions for me? So a brand new religious movement starts. It's called the Enlightenment. Unlike Puritanism or Calvinism or Protestantism or Catholicism, this is not a movement centered on Jesus. This is a movement centered on the opposite of such. This is a movement centered on, I don't think there is a God, and even if there was, you couldn't prove it anyway, so we're going to reject God and we're going to reject religion. The Enlightenment is a period of time when people say, we know more now than we did before, and we know too much to believe in God. God is something that you use to control people with. God is something you use that governments use to control us and to make us do the things that we're supposed to do. Sound familiar? Have you ever heard this before? Before you think it's something new that's popping up now and that people are saying now, they've been saying it for hundreds of years. The Enlightenment started, and people began to become disillusioned with faith. Now, they remained in church because they had to. Remember that sometime after this, not very long after this, about 70 years after John Wesley was born, a group of English citizens were sick of being told that they had to be part of the Church of England, so they grabbed their rifles and said, hey, England, we're claiming our independence, right? And we started a war, and we are the United States of America today because of, essentially, the Enlightenment, in a way. We often get this image that the Founding Fathers were fighting to be able to worship God, but that's not quite true. They were fighting to be able to worship God in their own way, which included, for several of them, not worshiping God. They were fighting for the right both to be either Protestant or Catholic on their own decision, and the right to be neither on their own decision. So obviously, people were obviously upset. This is what's happening in this time period. And the reason I'm bringing all that up is because we need to understand the world. Before we really dive into the next 6 weeks and understand Wesley, we need to understand his world, the world that he lived in. Amazingly, it's a lot like ours, isn't it? Amazingly, it's a lot like ours. How many times have you heard, and if you haven't, you need to talk to some folks, because I guarantee you'll hear this. You'll hear somebody tell you, well, the biggest reason I don't go to church, maybe they're Christian and they just don't go to church, or the biggest reason that I'm rejecting faith altogether and I don't want to be a Christian, is because nobody can figure it out anyway. You're all arguing amongst yourselves about theology and about things that really don't matter. And if all these churches together can't agree on a theology, then what's to say that the one I'm going to is the right one? And they even go on beyond that, and they say, you know, I'm rejecting faith because I think you're just using it to control people. I think you're just using it to get people to do things that you want them to do. I don't think it's genuine. People are saying those things today, and they were saying those things then. So the question is, what happened? How come when they say these things today, the church is in decline, and when they said those things then, the church grew tremendously? Well, the difference was a passion for the gospel. The difference was the people of God who weren't saying those things and what they did about it. When John Wesley started, he was kind of fighting with a couple other religious movements that were beginning. Famously, John Calvin, who was an attorney. John Calvin was an attorney who wanted to see a kind of different breed of Protestantism, if you will. Then there's also the Puritan movement, which eventually grew into the Baptist and Pentecostal churches and had its influence on the Methodist church. Movements that started kind of in that same region of Europe where people wanted to understand different theologies, but they were kind of focusing on theology. It was still more about theology. It was more about who's right and who's wrong. It was more about dividing lines than bringing people together. John Wesley was born into a world with a little bit of a different idea. John Wesley was born to a couple by the name of Susanna and Samuel Wesley. Samuel was the rector of a church in Epworth, of the cathedral in Epworth. The rector is the senior pastor, if you will. He is the appointed pastor to the church. He was a priest, and they lived in the rectory, the parsonage, if you will. They lived there, and which was it's a pretty big building, but at the same time, if you've ever been there, it's not as big as you think it'd be for having that many kids, and a lot of it's been added on since. There's a story that we'll get into later of that rectory burning and John Wesley being saved from the burning building and those sorts of things, but today we're going to focus more on his life living in that new rectory after the fire. See, Susanna used the kitchen to teach. And every day her children, she had several, she had many, many children, would get together in the kitchen, and she would spend about 6 hours every day teaching her children about God. Every day, 6 hours, she would teach her children about God. And they would go to church regularly. In fact, in that church, that cathedral in Epworth today, you can go and there's actually the chalice that John Wesley received First Communion from when he was 8 years old. John Wesley was baptized in that same church. So his life really centered around that church and his religious education. As a matter of fact, Susanna was famous for her education. And really, this is probably where John Wesley got his passion for seeing women in ministry roles, even as early as the 1700s. Because a little thing that happened, you see, Samuel Wesley was sent to a conference in London. He had to spend some time in London with some bishops and to spend some time learning. And the curate, or associate pastor, if you will, was set to preach. This individual was not well-educated. He was essentially a layperson. And he was not a very good preacher. He was dull, his theology was bad, and people really didn't like what he had to say. So, to his chagrin, they went to the parsonage. They went to the rectory. And they sat down with Susanna and her kids in the kitchen, and they pulled up a chair and they listened to her lecture her children about God. And they learned a tremendous amount. The associate pastor writes Samuel and says, you have got to put a stop to this. This is a problem. You cannot have a woman teaching the people of this church. That's my responsibility and your responsibility as men of God. You cannot have them teaching the church. So Samuel writes him a letter. I got to find it in my notes real quick. He writes him a letter. Well, I can't find it, but I know what was in it. I'm going to have to paraphrase, but he writes him a letter. He basically tells him, he says, you know what, you're in charge when I'm gone. That's your decision to make. If you want to tell the men and women of our church that they should not go to the parsonage, to the rectory, and they should not learn from Susanna, then you're free to do that. If you want to tell them that they cannot learn from a woman, they can only learn from a man, you're free to do that. And then he finishes his letter. He says, however, I want you to know that I am not responsible for the judgment that comes from the Lord our, he puts it in all caps, the Lord our God. I'm not responsible for the judgment that comes from the Lord our God when you tell him that you took these people away from religious education that they needed, that they were learning about God, growing in their faith, becoming closer to God, and you pulled them away from that. When God judges you for that, I am not going to be anywhere near you. Interestingly enough, Samuel stopped getting letters after that. John Wesley grew up with an incredible passion for education. He later became an Oxford professor. He understood the importance of education. It's because his mother spent hours with him every day teaching him about God. His mother didn't go and get him baptized and then 6 months later take him to church for Easter. His mother spent 6 hours a day teaching him about God. Because his mother knew that it was so very important that John Wesley and the rest of his siblings understood God wholly and completely. Because it's not enough to have a faith in God. Susanna understood that. Paul understood that. But it seems for a lot of people, they didn't understand that. Susanna understood that it's not enough to have a faith in God. Faith in God may be where our salvation comes, but something should come after that. It's not enough just to have a faith in God. We have to know God, and we have to grow in that faith. And if that faith is alive, it has to grow and develop. So Susanna made it incredibly important to teach her children about God. And that mirrored in John Wesley. John Wesley then spent his life teaching people about God. John's faith was formed by passionate people who wanted him to learn about God. And this is what I want us to grab about this. John Wesley was born into a world in turmoil. He was born into a world that says, God doesn't need me and I don't need God. And born into a world that the religious people who were religious were fighting amongst themselves about theology and about things that don't matter. Things that do matter but don't matter as much as they may seem to matter. Things as crazy as how to understand the Trinity. They all understood the Trinity, but how do you understand it? Is it this way or is it that way? Is it like a three-leaf clover or is it like water, ice, and steam? You know, there's a tremendous amount of debate over silly things. John Wesley took a passion to just let them understand God. You can fight among theology while your people leave, or you can spend time with them and let them know about God and let them know that there's a God who loves them and that they need to learn as much as they can about him so that they, like Paul sent his people, can go and defend the faith for themselves. He also found out that there was a passion lost. John Wesley went into churches and he got kicked out. We'll get on that later, but just briefly, he got kicked out of almost every church he preached in after a certain point. He was very unsuccessful as a priest and then later on was kicked out of quite a few churches because they didn't like what he had to say. So then he went out into the fields and preached to whoever would listen and gathered crowds of thousands and started an entirely new church. The reason that worked is because he went and preached to people without a passion for God and it didn't work. His style of preaching didn't work for people without passion for God. They just wanted to be entertained. They wanted to get fed, right? That's the word, right? They wanted to come in, sit down, enjoy the music, get a sermon that uplifted them, and then go home and ignore everything the sermon said, right? But John Wesley's preaching wasn't like that. John Wesley's preaching was for people who were passionate about God, who had a spiritual life that needed to grow. It didn't fit well in the church, but it worked really well with all the people who were outside of the church. John Wesley figured something out. He figured out that the people in church are not the source of growth for the church. It's the people outside the church who are disillusioned by faith, who have said, I don't want to have anything to do with faith because it's so messed up. John Wesley found out that if you go out to those people and you tell them, hey, you need to understand who God really is, you need to learn about God, you need to not worry about what the church fights about, you need to worry about who God is, then an amazing thing happens in that they have found their first love in a way that we have lost it. John Wesley also learned another thing, and something I want to leave you with this morning. John Wesley had a simple solution for the turmoil in the Catholic Church, in the Church of England. He called it the Catholic Spirit. Now, Catholic, not meaning Roman Catholic, meaning universal, meaning what that word actually means. He says we're all part of the same holy Catholic Church, the same universal church. Every denomination, every Christian, everyone who confesses Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior is part of the same universal church. John Wesley said that Catholic Spirit, that universal spirit, lives within each and every one of us. That's a spirit that we need to embrace. A spirit not of turmoil and struggle, but instead a spirit of loving God, learning from God, growing in God. And it doesn't mean that you just ignore your own denominational affiliations or defending the faith as you understand it. It means, in fact, that you should understand your own theology. But it also means that instead of squabbling with one another about theology, instead of squabbling with one another about whose church is right and who isn't, maybe we should focus instead on finding the folks who don't really know anything about God. Maybe instead we should focus on them and bring them to God and show them peace and love rather than squabbling with the people who already have an understanding of God and trying to convert them to our understanding of God. It's a beautiful thing when we agree on the essential doctrines but then begin to ignore the things that aren't as important. Each week during the series, I'm going to leave you with a quote from John Wesley. Now, this week's quote talks about the Catholic spirit, and I'm beginning my series with two of my favorite. I think number two and number three. I'll give you my number one favorite quote later. But my number two and number three favorite quotes I'm going to leave you with today. And the first one actually comes from John Wesley's sermon entitled The Catholic Spirit. And it says this. It says, though we cannot think alike, may we not be of one heart, though we are not of one opinion. Without all doubt, we may. Herein, all the children of God may unite, notwithstanding these differences. These remaining as they are, they may be forward one another in love and in good works. John leaves us with that quote and says that we're not going to agree on everything, but we're not supposed to either. We're supposed to have a passion for God. We can worry about theology when we're on fire for God, but until then, we've got nothing to fight about. We can worry about sin and differences and theological differences and denominational differences and whether or not the government should allow this or that when we have such a passion for God that the whole world knows about him, but until then, we've got nothing to talk about except to get our first love back. And to get that passion for God back to being a part of us. The other quote I'm going to leave you with is my number two favorite. That's a quote from John Wesley when he was talking about why enthusiasm and passion matters. Why can't you just come to church? Why can't you just sit in the pew? Why can't you just, you know, Christmas and Easter, that's good enough. Why can't you just do the things, you know, check off the list and be done? Why is it that we have to be passionate about God? Why do we have to have this deep, committed relationship with God in order to be successful? And he left them with a pretty funny and pretty true quote. He said, if you catch yourself on fire for enthusiasm, people will come from miles to watch you burn. We're going to close this morning. I'm going to ask our ushers to come forward as we receive our offering and as we kind of contemplate what it means for us to be passionate, revivalized, is that a word? It is now. Revivalized people of God who grow the church because of our passion for God.